Theater Department wants to pass along that tonight's performance, which was scheduled here on campus of HFC 23, was scheduled to be tonight, but is being postponed because of the anticipated weather, which is coming our way, obviously, as we speak here in southeastern Michigan. We'll have more on that a little bit later on in the future. It's a wonderful opportunity and a wonderful program that we're setting up here at Henry Ford College. But we'll talk about that a little bit later on. So instead of that, we wanted to make sure you knew, in case anybody was planning on coming to campus this evening for that particular theater performance, that it has been postponed. But that said, as we turn the calendar from February to March, we now enter Women's History Month here on the WHFR Journal. And on our program today, we bring you a special called Global Women Fighting Back. It's about how women overcome economic barriers to empower themselves and their communities, hosted by Rena Neenan. We'll hear about justice for domestic migrant workers in Gulf states, the financial factors behind female genital mutilation, and a program in the Congo working to overcome long-standing cultural barriers to women owning land. Let's listen to it now. Hope you enjoy on today's WHFR Journal.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, married couples can co-own property, but in practice, few wives really do. A big reason? Their sons are against it.
We argue a lot with my parents, asking why our mom should be given a land and not me, their eldest son.
Welcome to The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, a show from Foreign Policy about women creating change through economic empowerment. I'm Rena Neenan. Today we look at how one program worked with families to try to overcome long-standing cultural barriers to women owning land. Later, you'll hear from Rosilla. She's using her computer skills to help fight back against child marriage and other harmful practices.
They brought us some computers and they told us you can think of something resourceful to do using the computer.
Those stories just ahead, but first, these headlines.
Sadia Salah is watching local women's football team called Nassim play a scrimmage. The team plays in Salah's neighborhood of Sidi Moumen, a sprawling low-income suburb of Casablanca. A former player herself, Salah, 38, says when she played, there were no girls' teams. She would have to sneak out onto the field just to get in a few touches on the ball.
The boys, they would follow us throwing stones. When we would enter the field, they would climb the walls and throw rocks and we would stop playing. What was crazy was, women wearing traditional clothing, they would peek over the wall and they would say, "Hey, come look, come look." They would call each other and just stare at us. We got embarrassed, so we stopped. They didn't mean to, but it was like they were kicking us out.
Today, many of the girls practicing here play in headscarves, wrapped extra tight for sport. And a group of boys huddles outside the fence, watching and criticizing almost every touch the girls make. Nassim is one of 24 teams in Morocco's premier division for women's football. The league began in 2004 and is run by the same federation as the men's teams. But Nassim's coach Adil Farah says the women's league is more disorganized.
They told us this season there will be support, but nothing has come. When we went to play FK Ben Salah, we borrowed money for transport. Today, the referees came, and we had to borrow money to pay them.
And it's difficult to compare the structure of men's and women's football in Morocco. Professional men's football is supported by youth structures like neighborhood teams, camps, and academies. Meanwhile, women's football has no organizational youth structures. So when young girls want to play football, they have to join the boys in the streets.
One day I was playing and Faraz was with his boys team and he saw me play. And he came up to me and said, "You must play with my team. You play well and you have good skill." And from then on, I was with him in Sidi Moumen.
That's 18-year-old Nassim player Ibtissam Jraidi. Jraidi says now there are many more girls in the streets playing football.
Now the problems are money, field, and the federation. we still haven't gotten our stipend yet.
The stipend is small. Each women's team gets 30,000 dirham, that's $4,000, a year to cover costs like equipment, transportation, and referees. If they have enough, the coaches try to give the girls extra money when they win. Meanwhile, the men's teams receive about twice that amount from the federation. And male players in the Premier Division typically have salaries that exceed what one girls' team gets in a year. Plus, the men's teams get support from a well-established football industry. They generate money from TV coverage, sponsorships, and ticket sales. Many girls' teams have looked for outside support, but few companies are lining up to sponsor them. Women's games, which are free, don't usually draw a crowd, let alone a paying crowd. Once a week on this daily sports radio show, journalist Hassan Manyani covers women's football. He interviews federation officials and coaches, and people are calling in.
It's the mentality around women, and also it's the federation which hardly manages to provide support or fund for the men's leagues. So now there is a sort of awareness that it has to reorganize and develop women's football. But it's coming. There is awareness. This is already a good thing.
Officials from Morocco's Soccer Federation did not make themselves available for the story, but Manyani predicts that solutions will not come easily. One of the biggest obstacles is that most of these girls in the league are still in high school. Men at their level are usually older or don't need to stay in school. For them, football can be a job. Soccer's international regulating body, FIFA, held a symposium on women's football 3 years ago. It said the next steps to develop the sport are to have more women as referees, coaches, and administrators.
The green walker.
Amel Boubia is a volunteer coach for the Nassim team.
Team. I want to play with Raja Ain Harouda, but I stopped to practice football because I want to be a good to be coach. I passed some course for football, and now I coach team Nassim Hamadi.
She's heard that this season the Moroccan Federation is looking to give extra money for coaches' salaries for the women's teams, but she's skeptical. 37-year-old Boubia has an impressive resume in women's sports. As a player and a coach, she's participated in women's football camps all over Morocco. But Boubia says she still can't find a salaried job in female sports. She uses herself as a cautionary tale.
The girls must give importance for their study because the sport now is without salary and not a job, only for your health. You can practice sport only for your health and for your feeling.
Boubia also knows that as girls get older, more of them are pressured to leave the game by their families and society. And in her own job search now, she's given up on Morocco. She's practicing her English in hopes of finding a job outside the country. And that's hard because she sees something unique in the Nassim girls, and she'd like to continue to coach them.
For the Sidi Moumen Nassim team, I think they will have a good future because they are all around the same age. They were born around 95, 94, 93, and they have potential, and hopefully they will do well.
On this morning, Boubia watches as the team plays on a wet and rocky field. An 18-year-old Ibtissam Jraidi is playing forward. While Jraidi's playing, she isn't focused on the obstacles she's overcome. She's not thinking about advancing women's sport in a Muslim country or giving confidence to young Moroccan girls. She says she's here for another reason.
Football, it's mixed into my blood. I can't spend a day without playing it.
And even the boys smirking behind the fence can't argue with that one. For Chicago Public Radio, I'm Lisa Matuska.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Rena Ninen. Welcome to the Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, a show about women creating change through economic empowerment. Today, we're focusing on inspiring grassroots efforts to build women's financial power in Africa. Later in the hour, you'll hear about an app called EndCut. It's trying to end female genital mutilation by addressing the hidden economic factors behind it. But first, let's go to the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The first meeting was a catastrophe. We didn't agree on anything at all. The ladies were asking for land, and the men were strict about not making that concession.
Jerome Kalibanya lives in Mazinzi, a village in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, quite close to the border with Rwanda. He was at a heated land rights meeting with his wife, Simire Mwatoto. While it is technically legal for couples to co-own a home, in practice, men are usually the sole owners of land. This is because customary law here, or traditional community laws, often claim that married women cannot own property. A nonprofit called Women for Women International had organized this meeting. The purpose was to educate couples about the value in having women co-own land. They recruited the participants through other programs they had in the village, including a Male Allies project. That's how Jerome had heard about it. The first meeting was hard, but in the second session, his opinions started to change.
In our customs, there are things that women don't do, or were not doing in the past, like eating egg or chicken or drinking milk. These things were considered taboo. But when the men realized that that was the past, we understood that women could also have land rights, just like men.
Jerome and Simire then decided that they would add Simire's name to their land title, and they wanted to tell their 12 children about it. In the end, their biggest obstacle to doing this was their eldest son, Naganu Damien's son.
Nikasirika san.
I was angry, and we argue a lot with my parents, asking why our mom should be given a land and not me, their eldest son.
For Foreign Policy, I'm Rena Ninen. On today's episode of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, we look at how one program in the Democratic Republic of Congo worked with families to try to overcome long-standing cultural barriers to women owning land. The United States Agency for International Development, USAID, has been funding efforts to bring about more gender equity there and other parts of Africa. In the second part of our episode, I talked to Isabel Coleman, the Deputy Administrator of USAID. She explains why the Biden administration is doubling down funding towards gender programming and how USAID plans to invest that financing. But first, let's go back to the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, and this plan to try and reverse these deep-seated patriarchal traditions. About 4 years ago, Rachel Boketa began working on changing people's minds about something known as the land tenure system.
The land tenure system is opaque and very complex. And then in Eastern DRC, where we work, it's further complicated by conflict, ongoing conflicts out there. So, and all this compounded by low status of women, they took women out of the picture, you know, like completely. So mobilizing community was a very difficult exercise, I have to say so, because, you know, it challenges all, like, the existing norms.
Boketa is a country director for Women for Women International. That's a group dedicated to helping women living in places that have undergone devastating conflict. The DRC is such a place. And while war officially ended there 20 years ago, the past couple of decades have been tainted by weak governments and sporadic violence. This is especially true in the eastern part of the country, where more than 100 armed groups are believed to be currently operating.
Fighting has resumed in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo between government troops and M23 fighters. The Congolese government has...
Thousands of Congolese are continuing to flee from their homes.
One reason there's so much conflict is because the DRC has massive natural resources. Boketa and her team believe that one way to stem this cycle of violence is to give women more economic agency, including over land.
We did a thorough gender analysis that revealed to us that in Eastern DRC, land was an important income generation source and also food production. And women do not have access to land. because of all the customary law and the tradition and the social norms. Normally, land belongs to men, and the male firstborn sons inherit those. So that for us was a huge gap, you know, to tackle for the project. And we built our project first to give women access to land, and second to promote their rights, and of course also fight GBV, gender-based violence in relation to that. So that's how the whole thing started.
Bokita decided to concentrate her efforts in the Eastern DRC, where women have been particularly impacted by conflict and a lack of information.
People out there in the Eastern DRC, they don't know that now women don't need authorization to get land title. So for them, it was still women cannot access land. They need marital authorization to do so, and all these things. So bringing our project, trying to mobilize community, challenging the statu quo was very difficult.
Bokita knew that if she wanted to make change, she needed allies.
Community mobilization was key.
Specifically, though, she needed men to join in and help with securing land rights for women. So she and her team set up to train men on how to convince their families, friends, and community members that women and girls' rights were important and that they had built trust with local leaders, including the head chief known as the King.
The community really got involved and supported the program. We even had, you know, the chief of the traditional chiefdom, it's called the Moami. He even lowered, you know, the price for women to get official land title. I remember I went with him in Nyangezi to deliver those land titles to women. So, you know, when the king is involved, all others, like authorities or all other subjects in those communities, got involved.
How did you manage to convince the king that he should support this policy of allowing mothers to own land rights?
You know, that's all advocacy is about. So it started by a series of communication, because that king himself, he lost his father when he was 6 years old, from what he told us. And then his mother was actually ruling the kingdom. And we told him, we say, if your mother could not have access to leadership, was not like allowed to rule the kingdom, it means your entire lineage, generation or family or your tribe would have lost the throne, because you were the only male son and then you were only 6 years old. So that convinced him, and then he got involved. He was actually pushing for women's leadership, and then he's even calling us, you know, to extend the project to other communities so that we could change, you know, this low status of women, which is being transmitted from generation to generation.
Can you explain why the sons were such an obstacle?
The sons, the firstborn sons, they are like the lawful in who inherits the land. So they were fighting their own mothers, because for all the men that agreed to give land title to women, it was like they were taking away their inheritance.
So they felt they were getting less of the pie, so they didn't want to share with their mothers.
Exactly.
All we had in our heads was women for women was coming after the first son's inheritance.
That's Ngannou Damien's son, the eldest son you heard from at the top. He then went to a land rights project meeting, especially for sons.
And it was hard to agree with that.
But they didn't give up. They kept engaging with the sons and implored them to see things through their mother's perspective.
We had to explain to them that when their mother gets their land, it's still for their own good, because it has been shown, you know, with women getting the land, plots of land, producing food, and then also producing other production for income generation that was helping the family. And then we explained to them about the rights that by the Constitution we are born equal, men and women. Women can also access land in the same way with men. So we are talking about their sisters, their mothers, and then their future wives.
They also brought up something more serious to really drive the point home.
There are practices where when the man is no more, his family can spoliate everything that belonged to men and often leave women and the kids in the street. So it was critical to explain to those youth that when maybe you are no more there, if your wife have access to your land, because it's the major like income generation, you know, source, it means your kids will be secure even if you are not there. And I think that one was part of what convinced them.
The strategy worked well on the Gandu Damien son.
The most important thing I've learned through those meetings, I pictured myself as a parent, and I realized that I can get also girls and have the rights to inherit from my goods. And then my mom, as well as my sisters, should have the same rights as men.
And Ndongo's mother? She didn't tell our producer much, but she was very happy about owning rights.
I felt so good when my husband gave me that land, and I was so thankful to him for giving me a land where I could grow beans, potatoes, or cassava. Thanks to this land, our own, if I harvest beans or potatoes that I sell to the market, I can pay the school fees for the kids, or buy some clothing for myself, and take my kids to the hospital or for medical care, or treat myself just from what I got from this field.
Our thanks to the Kalibanya family for sharing their story with us, and special thanks to our DRC-based journalist, Francis Shok Mwaze, who acted as our field producer for this segment. The Women for Women International Project in DRC changed the minds of men and boys about women owning land. Women for Women was supported in their efforts with a grant from the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. The U.S. currently gives more money to international development than any other country in the world. After the break, you'll hear my conversation with USAID Deputy Administrator Isabel Coleman about how USAID is approaching gender equality. To hear more stories about women breaking barriers, please check out our podcast, The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, where you can now binge all of season 3. We'll have a brand new season out this summer. Next up, we'll hear from a group of girls developing an app to try to end female genital mutilation by addressing the economic reasons it's still prevalent. That story after the break.
I believe that the flying saucers are objects from another planet.
The Navy has no saucer-shaped aircraft or missile.
There's no good reason for keeping this secret for 3 decades.
The government's been lying about UFOs for 50 years.
What is that?
Oh okay.
5, 6, 7 light.
You guys ever seen anything like this before?
That's one object.
Whoa.
That's definitely not a plane. What do you think that was?
I'm David Twitchell. Join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will separate the facts from the fiction on We Are Not Alone. Only on WHFR.FM. It's 89.3 FM. That's the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. We are not alone.
Welcome back to The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, a production of Foreign Policy. I'm Rena Ninen. we wanted to share a conversation that I had with USAID Deputy Administrator Isabel Coleman at Foreign Policy's Her Power Summit. This is an event all about women's leadership. Coleman shared with me what she thinks are the smartest ways to invest in women and girls around the world.
When you're looking and applying sort of a gender lens to development, I know President Biden's new budget now calls for more than double, actually, money for gender programs in the previous year. Why is that? What do you think the White House is hoping to achieve?
I think everybody in this room knows the why. The why has been documented and researched and written about for decades. When you invest in women and girls, it has such a positive impact, not only on the girl child, but on her family, on her community, on her country, on the global economy. We've seen it, you know, across the board. Investing in women produces better health outcomes, it reduces fertility, it improves farmer yields. I wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs almost 20 years ago called The Payoff from Women's Rights. Mm. And I don't want to spend time anymore talking about why.
Yes. So,
but let's focus on the how.
On the how. So what is the White House hoping to achieve and how will they do it?
So in the fiscal year 23 budget request, as you noted, we have requested a doubling of our funding for programs to invest in women and girls. I mean, what we're hoping to achieve is much greater impact, you know, more than a doubling of impact.
What does that mean when they say greater impact? Where would you believe that you and the White House would look at this and say, we took this money and it really paid off?
Well, it really cuts across everything we do today. I mean, you can't just say, oh, this is our gender pot. You know, we find our gender money is in our agricultural spending. It's in our climate work. It's certainly in our educational work. We've just invested $50 million in the World Bank's CARE initiative. The World Bank has estimated that some 600 million women are not in the workforce today because of lack of access to care, you know, whether it's for child care, elder care, whatever it may be. 75% of unpaid care in the world is done by women. So that's just one example. But, you know, certainly when we're looking at food security around the world, we know that the majority today of subsistence farmers are women, and women have lower productivity than men. If you can invest in women's productive capacities, and it could be literacy training, you know, at the earliest levels to improve their productivity, you're going to have increases in food security around the world. So it really is across the board on everything that we're doing.
Can you point to what USAID has done in the space of women and girls where there's been some sort of transformative change?
Oh, I mean, there's so many examples. Right now, USAID is supporting 12 million girls in primary school around the world. And that is just this year.
Yeah.
You know, for decades, we have invested in girls' education. And you've seen the gains. Bangladesh has seen enormous strides. The U.S. has invested heavily in women and girls' empowerment and education and in Bangladesh and in countries around the world. So Egypt, you know, girls' education, you've seen enormous strides in closing the gender gaps. Not that they have been fully closed, but you've seen a lot of progress. And USAID has really been behind a lot of those U.S. government investments that have been made.
You just returned from a trip to Niger, which there is explosive population growth. But it's fascinating. There's also been some investment in women's girls' education. Tell me a little bit about what you saw.
Well, let me step back. And even before I went to Niger, I had an amazing conversation with the foreign minister who was here, who was talking about his challenges that he faces. He said, I face three challenges, three crises. I face a climate crisis. Mm-hmm. The country is in the Sahel, and it's seen rapid desertification. It faces conflict in the north of the country and in the south, across the country, and it's really conflict driven by a growing scarcity of resources. And then he took me by surprise, and he said, and my third crisis is child marriage. And I thought, wow, that's interesting to have a foreign minister talking about child marriage. And he said, look, I have a population of 26 million people, It is one of the fastest, I think it is the fastest growth rate, fertility rate in the world today. Wow. A Nigerian woman is likely to have 7 children right now, which is fully one more child than the next highest, which means that the population will double every 18 years. And when you're looking at conflict and climate change, a doubling of your population puts enormous stresses. It's a source of opportunity, of course, but it's also puts enormous stress on your systems or lack of systems. They don't have the ability to have all of their kids in school, and with such a fast-growing population, they have to invest. So it is a challenge. And girls, the girl child is so crucial to the gains that they want to make across the board. And they recognize that in Niger, 76% of girls are married before the age of 18, and a very large proportion are married before the age of 15, 14, 13. You have very young ages of marriage. Girls leave school for a whole variety of reasons. There's no sanitation facilities for women, for girls. Schools are a long distance. You know, they're cultural factors. And when they leave school, they get married. Mm-hmm. And so one of the programs that we're doing in Niger is really trying to address that issue, those structural factors that really drive early marriage in Niger.
I find sometimes it's also the same when you're talking about diversity, when you're talking about gender issues. There's still this sense among policy leaders, you know, largely men, that feel this is sort of the feel-good thing. I've got to do this to check off the box for the U.S. or for the IMF or for the World Bank. Do you find that sentiment? I know we talked about it's not so much the why anymore. How has tangible differences been, you know, happened to these countries that might be on the fence about this?
I have been working in this space for a very long time, and I've been writing about these issues for a very long time. And I can tell you that 20 years ago, when I would sit down with finance ministers or labor ministers, and I would talk about the low workforce participation rate of women in their economies, they'd say, oh, but you know, we have to find jobs for men first. Yeah. You know, women, they should stay home and take care of their kids. They need jobs first. We can't even employ the men. How can we think about the women? And I would show them research where countries that had higher workforce participation rates of women had higher workforce participation rates for men, too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not zero sum. Women create jobs for other women and for men. And you could see them thinking, okay, today you have the foreign minister in Niger talking about child marriage. That is one of his priorities. I think there's been so much research done looking at, for example, the work that McKinsey has done. If you can bring women up to the same level of equality, economic opportunity and education, all sorts of things, around the world, it's $28 trillion of additional global GDP. Mm-hmm. That's 26%, more than a quarter of the world's economy. And I think that people in leadership positions in countries now much better understand this is not just checking a box to make the United States feel good. This is critical to their economic development. It is critical to their outcomes that they're looking for. We know it's a human rights issue. It's also an economic issue.
Final question. I know we've got to wrap up shortly here, but when you look at everything you've outlined for USAID, the policies, the review that you've just conducted, where do you believe you can see the most change in the coming years of this administration?
I think that the harsh reality is that COVID was a huge setback for women and girls. You saw girls leave school, and there's a whole generation of girls, they're never going back. Mm-hmm. You saw women leave the workforce, and they're really going to lose years, if not decades, off their productive ability to participate in the economy. And I think that the focus and push that we have is to try to reverse those setbacks and really turbocharge the opportunities for women and girls. So it's doubling down again on education, on the care economy as an enabler for helping girls and women participate more fully and realize their full capacities. Of course, food security is one of our highest priorities right now because of Russia's terrible invasion of Ukraine and destruction of the world's breadbasket in many ways. And making sure that the investments we're making in food security and really down at, you know, the subsistence farming level are very much focused on women too. We're likely to see the biggest gains. So, and climate. I mean, yes. they're you know, I haven't even talked much about that, but making sure that even just, I mentioned, you know, increasing women's agricultural productivity allows less tilling of land and less use of fertilizer. I mean, the positive spillover effects are huge, but across the board, education, economic opportunities, climate change, and then also the legal environment. You know, we continue to work with brave civil society actors around the world to really push on closing the legal gaps that exist for women.
Yeah, food security, climate, legal issues. You're so right to raise that. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you so much, Isabel Coleman, with USAID, for your work decades in this space and holding people accountable on this. So thank you.
Thank you.
The interview was filmed live at Foreign Policy's Her Power Summit in Washington, D.C., at an annual gathering of leaders defending women's rights and ensuring greater equity and inclusion around the world. Next up, we'll hear from a group of girls developing an app to try to end female genital mutilation by addressing the economic reasons it's still prevalent. That story after the break.
Everybody, are you ready for a rock and blues blowout? And be sure to check out the Go With The Flow Mike Holloway show every Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. right here on WHFR.FM, the station that is always making waves.
Welcome back to The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, a production of Foreign Policy. I'm Rena Ninen. If you're enjoying the story, please check out our podcast, The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women. Our third season just ended, and we'll have a brand new one out this summer. Now, we're headed to Kenya. Reporter Eunice Mina has a story about a group of girls combating a devastating cultural practice. That practice was countered by opening up new economic opportunities. And just a warning, this involves sexual content. You may want to listen without young children around.
It's 5:30 p.m. here in Wamba Town, Samburu County, in the northern part of Kenya. Wamba is surrounded by hills, most of which are flat at the top. The main community here are the Samburu people, who are semi-nomadic. They're also known as the butterfly people, because of the bright red colors, bracelets, and beaded necklaces they adorn themselves in. Here, the elders, who are usually older men, rule the community and make all important decisions. This includes ceremonies such as weddings and other rites of passage. Unfortunately, outdated practices still persist in Samburu communities, such as early child marriages and female genital mutilation, or FGM. Lately, there has been a movement to end FGM. Wamba Town is a 9-hour drive from Nairobi via Mararal. The journey from Mararal to Wamba required us to drive on rocky, dusty roads. On the way, we came across zebras, ostriches, and elephants. I covered all this distance to meet a remarkable young lady.
My name is Rosella Nanyike, and I'm in Form 4 in a school called St. Teresa's, Samburu East. I joined the school 2019.
Rosilla is in her final semester of high school. Although she's just 17, she was robbed of her childhood years ago.
I was married off when I was 9 years old. I stayed with my father. My mother passed on when I was 6 years old. And my father decided to marry me off to an old man who was almost 42 years old.
In the Samburu community, before a girl is married off, she first has to undergo female circumcision, which involves harming the genitalia. Rosilla was no exception. The painful ritual was conducted by elderly women in the village.
I was cut and I was taken to the man's home. I stayed there for a week and they started assigning duties to me. So I was given a duty of selling milk in the market.
It was during one of those market trips that Rosila met a local activist who completely changed the course of her life.
That's where I met Dr. Josephine Claire, and she actually saw that I was married. And you know, when you're married in the Samburu community, you have a chain that shows that you are a wife of someone. So she was really shocked. I was a very small kid.
Right then and there, Dr. Claire took Rosila with her and helped her start a new life away from her husband.
She rescued me, and I'm very grateful. She took me to school, and now I'm in Form 4, hoping to complete in a month's time. I'm very happy and very grateful to Mom. I love her so much, and also thank God for this.
Since then, Rosila's life has been completely transformed, and so has the lives of over 1,000 other girls rescued by Dr. Kulea and her organization, the Samburu Girls Foundation. Through this foundation, Rosila experienced a second life-changing moment. That happened when Safaricom, one of Kenya's leading telecommunications companies, offered to support young girls at the rescue center through computer lessons.
We had two mentors from Safaricom. They brought us some computers and they told us you can do some computer lessons and you can think of something resourceful to do using the computer. They said they want 12 girls to be learning computers. And since I'm so passionate about things to do with technology, every day I'm there.
As part of the sponsorship, Safaricom encouraged the girls to take part in the Technovation Challenge, a global competition run by an American nonprofit which seeks to promote technology and entrepreneurship for girls. The competition is open to young girls across the world between the ages of 8 and 18. They are judged on how well they are able to use technology to solve real-world problems. Rosila, together with four girls from the rescue center, decided to put their computer skills to practice. They formed a team and named it Almasi.
We got this partnership with the Safaricom. They came to us one day and they asked us if we can identify the problem we face as girls, and that's when we came up with the app called EndCut.
The technical lead for Team Almasi is Dorcas Kanipa.
We sat down and said, how will we help other girls who are not rescued as us? And this practice, which is against the rights of humanity, we come up with that app.
Rosila and her teammates recognized that poverty was the enemy and the main reason why many young girls were getting circumcised and married off. EndCut was created with the main purpose of bringing financial freedom for Samburu women and others from surrounding communities who are still performing FGM, says Jacinta Lerte, another of Rosila's teammates.
We created that app to help Samburu women, where they'll be making beads, and then they'll be using that app to sell their beads. This will help to reduce the rates of poverty, mostly, which is somehow related to FGM.
To further explain, the elder women who perform these circumcisions get paid for conducting the practice, and so it's an important source of income for them. The app therefore offers them another choice by creating a new marketplace for beads and other crafts.
They will be selling their beads through the app. Then the money that they get, it will help them to raise their standards of living.
Apart from just raising the standard of living, the idea is that this new source of income will dissuade these elder women from cutting girls, since they'll no longer need the money from conducting the practice.
That's the main reason why Samburu women are performing in FGM.
In early October, the Almasi team were declared junior finalists at the Technovation Challenge 2022 for creating the EndCut app. Rosila's teammate Dorcas says that when you empower women and girls, big things happen.
It was something that we cannot even imagine that we were going to win. And I can say we were extremely happy. The only thing that can limit you is yourself, and I've been praying to God that He can give me that determination in myself that I'll be able to make other girls like me to see the bright future ahead.
The EndCut app is the first of its kind in Samburu, and despite winning this prestigious award, Jacinta tells me that there is still a lot of challenges before the app becomes effective when it launches later this year. The main one being that many of the older people in Samburu do not own smartphones. So for now, The team is focusing on introducing it to those who have a phone and are more educated.
I think we'll just find some women, then we tell them about the app, and then they will help us to tell the others.
Despite this challenge, Rosila is optimistic that the app will catch on. She sees it as part of a larger movement to change the mindset of communities still tied to outdated cultural practices.
My message to all girls, especially the girls who are undergoing the challenges, I want to tell them that you should not give up. Keep on the spirit of fighting for your rights and stand for the truth.
Rosila is excited to provide a new economic opportunity for women and a new way for them to stand up and take control of their lives. For the Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, I'm Eunice Minor.
If you're enjoying this story, please check out our podcast, The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women. Our season just ended, and we'll have a brand new one out this summer. According to the International Labor Organization, nearly 20% of all domestic workers are migrant workers. This means they move to a different country to do domestic labor, clean houses, prepare food, take care of children. Most of them are female. It's important, hard labor. Migrant domestic workers are particularly common in Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia. And Kenya sends a lot of domestic workers to these countries. More than half of the 87,000 or so Kenyans employed in the Middle East since 2019 are domestic workers. It's a big source of income. Kenyans living in Saudi Arabia send the third largest amount of money to families at home. That's after the U.S. and the U.K. But many women returning from this work describe horrific circumstances, particularly in Saudi Arabia. And in an alarming number of cases, death. Reporter Pauline Ungaji has more.
It is a typical chilly evening in Omwaro village, Nyamira County, a five-hour drive from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. It rains heavily all year round in this part of the country, and today is no different. It has been wet for the most of the day, and so we have to navigate through narrow, muddy pathways in between thickets, leading us to Florence Nyanchama's homestead, a couple hundred meters from the main dirt road into the village. Florence is the mother of Deborah Nyanchoka, who in January 2020 traveled to Saudi Arabia to work as her housemaid.
Reaching Saudi Arabia, I was received by an agent. Immediately, I got at the airport. They took my passport. They take everything you have that is official. So they put us in a taxi. We were 12 of us. Then we were taken to the hostel. So then my boss came the same day and took me to another city called Dammam. So that is where I worked for 26 months.
Here in Kenya, women who seek domestic work abroad are often perceived as uneducated and without skill. But that's not the case for Deborah. She graduated in 2015 with a degree in Bachelor of Science in Entrepreneurship from Moi University, one of the most prestigious schools in Kenya. Despite doing everything she could to better herself, she still felt like her only way to make a decent salary was to go abroad.
My work was to do cleaning, cook, take care of the kids. The family had 8 kids. Everything that was being done, I was alone. I was working in 16 rooms. The house was big, and I was working for 18 hours, sometimes 17 hours. Wake up at 6 and sleep at 12 midnight.
Deborah's plan worked to some extent, at least. She was able to earn enough to send money home and support her two children living with Florence.
My mom is just a widow, and they were all depending on me. I'm the breadwinner.
But even as she was sending money back home, things were getting harder for this mother of two as the work situation deteriorated each passing day.
Personally, I survived the death 2 times. The first time, there was a kid in that house who got COVID-19. So they left us, the two of us, without informing me. So they gave me instructions on how to take care of that kid until they came back for the 2-week quarantine, the 14 days. The second experience, it happened after 18 months. I was working for those long hours and my legs got swollen. I was very weak. I couldn't walk, but I used to tell my boss to take me to the hospital. And if you tell them to take you to the hospital, they think that you are faking everything. So she just ignored me in the house. Then I decided to go with my phone to the bathroom to make a call to my Kenyan agent. All of a sudden, I just fell down. I was hearing everything, but I couldn't stand. And then she took a long time to come. So around 2 hours, that is when she came. And then she just took water from the running tap and poured on me 3 packets of water. And then she just closed the door and went. She never came back. I was just down there until around midnight. That is when I became a bit conscious. I took my phone, then I recorded an audio clip, sent it to my agent in Kenya and told him what was happening. That was the first time he just responded, because before, earlier, I used to tell him that I was in a problem, but he used to ignore. But that day, I don't know, God touched him. He decided to contact the office in Saudi Arabia, and the office contacted the father of the house. And that is that man called the wife. That is when they took me to the hospital.
And so she has since adopted the Monica Lacking Mom, a name that she says depicts just how fortunate she was to come back home safely.
That is the main reason I call myself the lucky mom, because even my friends, we were 12 of us, but 4 of them died, and we remained 8 of us alive.
As horrible as it sounds, it's unfortunately all too common here in Kenya. Many women who find domestic work in Gulf states come back home either maimed or scarred, and in worst case scenarios, they come back in caskets. A report by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs presented to the Kenyan Parliament last year showed that at least 89 Kenyans, most of whom were domestic workers, died in Saudi Arabia between 2020 and 2021. But the problem goes far beyond deaths. In September of 2022, an investigation by the Kenya's Commission on Administration of Justice revealed horrifying details on the state of domestic workers living in Saudi Arabia. Mercy Wambua is the commission's secretary.
The investigations found out that there are major forms of abuses experienced by domestic workers in Saudi Arabia. And this range from passport confiscation, physical abuses, sexual abuses, sleep deprivation, food deprivation, labor exploitation, movement restrictions, and imprisonment prior to deportation. They also face challenges of religious intolerance and psychological abuse.
Even though cases have continued to spark alarm and outrage among Kenyans, there still remains too little to no oversight of Kenyans working abroad, and there's rarely, if any, repercussions of abusive employers of domestic workers.
We also established that the National Employment Authority lacks a sufficient legal and enforcement framework for dealing with rogue recruitment agencies.
Kenyan women are recruited to travel to the Gulf and other places in the Middle East through local agencies. They are lured by the promise of big salaries, but when something goes wrong, these agents are hard to find and evade law enforcement. The affected families are therefore left to bear the pain alone and helplessly watch as their daughters and wives become just another statistic.
In Kenya, we have many labor laws, but the relevant ones do not refer direct to labor exploitation and thus cannot protect migrant workers. However, we also established that the drafting of a labor migration management bill as well as a national labor migration policy are underway. Once they are enacted, they will be able to address some of the systemic and legal gaps identified by our investigations.
The fight for domestic workers now falls to a new generation of activists such as Emma Mbura, a former senator in Kenya.
I come from a very poor family. I gave birth when I was only 16 years. I dropped out of school. I decided to work as a nanny. What I saw in Saudi
made me decide to advocate for Middle East domestic workers.
Emma has used extreme tactics to make a point about this issue.
I've been making noise and seeing many girls coming back home because I threatened to strip naked if they don't bring back home.
Last year, she even threatened to commit suicide if the former president, Uhuru Kenyatta, and his administration continued to ignore the plight of Kenyan women traveling to the Gulf in search of domestic jobs.
Many times I use WhatsApp to record my voice, and you know, it goes viral. I threatened to commit suicide if they don't bring the... There were three girls, and they were brought back home.
Emma's efforts to help domestic workers and their families hasn't been limited to trying to change laws and influence the government. Over the years, she has trekked all over the country to meet individual families and try to assist them as best as she can. Oftentimes, this means digging deep into her own pockets to help bring back stranded women or their bodies from the Middle East.
I had to use my money. Part of the money was mine, so you see.
Seeing how big the problem is and how much need is out there, Emma has decided to start a non-profit organization dedicated to helping Kenyan domestic workers living abroad. She hopes to not only help women who are stranded, but provide alternative economic opportunities for women in Kenya and therefore reducing the need to work abroad in the first place.
Majority who are going there are very young girls. Maybe they have one child, they are from broken marriages, they cannot make ends meet, they have no papers. The only way they can be employed is Saudi.
Emma's plan includes educating girls on the dangers of working abroad, as well as trying to ensure that more complete their education. Even still, finding work within Kenya continues to be a challenge. Remember Deborah? She had an advanced degree in entrepreneurship and a certificate in accounting and still felt the need to work abroad. This brings us back to the government. In September, Kenya saw William Ruto take over the presidency from Kenyatta. And so far, there is hope that this administration is more open to reforms.
I'm going to work closely with the Saudi Arabian embassy and investigate each and every death that has occurred so that each and every person who participated in the death of these girls is brought to book and charged.
Early November, Kenya's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Dr. Alfred Mutua, traveled to Saudi Arabia to meet the authorities there, where on top of his agenda was discussions on challenges faced by Kenyan workers.
The Saudi Arabian government has said that they are shocked by the reports that they have seen, and they are going to work hand in hand with us to ensure that the things that we see reported do not appear ever again.
He held several meetings with Saudi government officials. They agreed to work on modalities for Kenyan workers.
Some of the new initiatives include the introduction of a wage protection program and a distress alert line to security agencies. The development follows incidents of deaths and torture of Kenyan.
But the problem goes far beyond deaths.
It is very clear to me that the problems that Kenyans are facing in Saudi Arabia actually do not start here, but start at home. The system is flawed and corrupt, and unless fixed, nothing will change. There is massive corruption in the way Kenyans are prepared to come to be domestic workers in Saudi Arabia. This is a major concern for all of us.
There have been unconfirmed cases linking past Kenyan government officials to recruiting agencies.
We have to break the cartels and streamline the agencies, some of which are owned by prominent Kenyans. We will, in collaboration with the Saudi government, flush out illegal agencies and blacklist agencies that do not perform as per the law. The rights of all workers, as enshrined by the laws of Saudi Arabia and Kenya, will be enforced.
So the evidence is compelling, the need of these women is immediate. The question remains, will these efforts be enough to protect Kenyan women working abroad? There's too much on the line for it not to. For the Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, I'm Pauline Ngaji.
Before we leave, one final word from Rachel Boketa, Women for Women International's country director in the Democratic Republic of Congo. to women watching and to people listening who really want to help change the way we view gender and legislation and create change for a better future, what's your advice to people who are fighting to implement change?
Yes, you know, sometimes people look for big things. By big things, I mean like law amendments or going to parliament discuss. But what I can say to women listening and to their husbands or the males in the community or to everyone involved, that it starts at the household. In that context of Eastern DRC, if each household can start, you know, by promoting women's rights, that's how it will change and it will be sustainable.
How beautiful. What an incredible closing thought. I'm Rena Ninen, and you've been listening to The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women. Laura Rosbrow-Tellum is our senior producer, Rob Sachs, our managing director. Foreign Policy's audio team includes Rosie Julin, Maria Jimena Aragon, Claudia Tatey, and Dan Efron. Our show is a production of Foreign Policy and is made possible through funding in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. If you like what you've heard, we hope that you'll check out our podcast. Our third season just ended, and our next season comes out this summer. Make sure to follow The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Winner of the Spirit of College Radio Award, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio featuring local and independent artists.
If you came across a child struggling with hunger, how would you recognize them?
By their clothes?
Their age? The way they speak?
Hunger can be hard to recognize. Learn why at IamHungerInAmerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America, 200 Food Banks Strong.
This is music by Clara Schumann.